Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we get to talk with Professor Isaiah Shai Arkin, Vice President for Research and Development at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, about this topic of publish or perish, the battle of science for your health.
An really interesting topic.
Yeah.
We're both finding it really interesting. Maybe this could be our chairman, or maybe this could be something that really is relevant to all scientists around the world, the generation of new knowledge.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the conversation and to tying it into your health and our listeners' health. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters for your health. We're going to talk about seeing and the color of your plate and whether that influences how much you eat.
How much do we like that color red? About lung cancer and the new screening test, and is it really under or over diagnosing lung cancer?
About soda and its relationship to cancer risk among women.
And then finally, about Parkinson's disease, and does it matter when you start exercising? Well, Christy, some important research, and I guess this very first one, we did a research that matters not too long ago about the size of the glasses.
Right, and how much wine you drink.
Tall and thin glasses, people drink less wine
than
the
big, short, wider glasses,
right? And if you had more contrast.
That's right. So if you had more contrast to the glass, if you were drinking red wine in a clear glass, you drank less than white wine in a clear glass. Anyway,
this research, which we'll have to decide whether or not it matters or not, but we liked it, really has to do with actually the color of the dishes that you serve on, because we're all trying to, or many of us, cut down on the amount of food. Obesity is such an important problem in the United States and internationally. Does the color of the plate influence the size of the portion you eat?
So this was research published in the journal Appetite, appropriately.
Good journal. I need to subscribe to it.
Exactly. I need that too. Where they had volunteers sort of rate popcorn saltiness, chocolate nuttiness, stickiness of hand cream and different things. And they had them test their eating and what they favored based on eating from three colors, a red plate, a white plate, or a blue plate.
That was very American of
yes,
them to
red,
do
white,
the red,
blue.
White, and blue. And surprisingly, at least to me, it made a difference that those who ate whatever they ate, because they could eat more of anything. If you like more popcorn, you're going to eat more popcorn than, let's say, dark chocolate. But you tended to eat less when it was on a red plate. And that didn't really matter on the type of food, which is really quite interesting.
Yeah. I mean, even if you were a popcorn fan or a chocolate fan or whatever, on average, people ate less popcorn or less chocolate if they were served on a red plate. Makes me want to go buy some red plates. But
well, and this is interesting in the standpoint when I oftentimes go out to a restaurant and I get served on a very large white plate, the meal looks very small.
Well, that's because you're going to fancy restaurants where they give you those tiny.
They don't give you very much. It looks small. It is small. So, but if you go to the restaurant and it's on a red plate, it maybe looks larger, but maybe I eat less. I don't know about this, Christy. I do think, because I've been talking about some people who do serve wine, and I said, you know, if you want your mm-hmm. guests to drink a little less wine to make sure that they're drinking and driving responsibly, you know, that tall, thin glass.
Uh-huh.
I don't know about this red plate serving. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think that we are all looking for ways to modify our health and modify the choices that we make. And this might be a way to influence that for you. So, I mean, there's certainly
Can't
not
hurt.
A lot of harm in it. Yeah.
Can't hurt there, as long as perhaps you make sure that you're serving healthy food on that red plate.
Yeah, that would be the best choice.
Okay. Let's talk about our very next research that matters that has to do with soda consumption and the risk of cancer among women. An article that was in the journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention.
Yeah, so this was a study of 23,000 women who were part of the Iowa Women's Health Study, and they looked at postmenopausal women and the relationship to how much sugar-sweetened soda and other sugary beverages, how much consumption they had of those sugary beverages, and then followed them and looked at their cancer risk.
And this was 23,000 women who were part of the Iowa Women's Health Study, followed from 1986 to 2010, over a long period of time. And over 500 of the women were diagnosed with type 1 endometrial cancer, a cancer that is more frequently diagnosed, as you said, Christy, postmenopausal, after the menopause, after the hormonal change, which frequently occurs in the early 50s.
What they found was that among these postmenopausal women, the ones who reported drinking the most servings of soda and other sugary beverages each week were 78 times more likely or 78% more likely to develop estrogen-dependent type 1 endometrial cancer. So we know that endometrial cancer is related to weight, but this also found not just about weight, but this relationship with the sugar beverages.
And my first instinct was say, oh, it's going to be confounded or, you know, it'll be really, it's the weight, not the sugar. But it turns out once you control for the weight, the association still held. And more importantly, those women who drank diet sodas actually did not have this association, which really implies there's something within the sugars that's stimulating insulin is having some impact. We don't know this for a causal relationship, but boy, there's one person in my family who's going to take notice, and I'm not going to say who.
Well, you know, I thought this was going to be about all sodas, and I have my one Coke Zero a day, so I was so happy to hear
that. You can keep doing it, Christy, and I can keep drinking my Diet Coke. But for many of our listeners out there, please do take note of this research. It's important. And speaking of research that's important, this next research has to do with lung cancer and lung cancer screening, Christy. Something we've heard a lot about in the last year. We've talked a little bit in this show with the new guidelines recommending for smokers of certain ages and smoking enough time that they do get lung cancer screening. Tell us about this study.
So this was research done at Duke University Medical Center looking at over 1,000 lung cancers that were reported in this group who had the CAT scans to diagnose and try to pick up cancers from this high-risk group. And they found that about 18.5% or almost 20% of the cancer diagnoses represented what we call an overdiagnosis, meaning that they found cancers that are so slow growing or would never have caused any harm to anyone and probably didn't matter that we found it.
Yeah, this was research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's journal Internal Medicine. And this is a little disturbing because for most listeners, most family members out there, when you tell them you have cancer, you want it out of your body. But we do know from that PSA testing,
from the prostate
specific antigen testing for prostate cancer, that we picked up many, many, many cancers over the years that likely never would have hurt someone. So we now, many of us don't recommend that testing because we're not convinced that, and the authorities don't recommend that testing, that we picked up too many cancers that wouldn't have hurt people.
And this is
doesn't, it's not the same thing here, but it's...
It's not, but it's confusing because most people think, you know, this, and for some cancers, the sooner you pick them up, the better. But in this case, you know, it causes a lot of harm to you when you hear that you have cancer and you spend a lot of money and a lot of emotional energy and all kinds of things that go on when you're given that diagnosis. And maybe we're finding things that wouldn't harm people. So stay tuned on this. But
and talk to your doctor and really get into detail about whether or not you, if you're qualified, if you really want that particular testing, which, again, the guidelines say perhaps you should, but we give a little caution. And our last research that matters is real quickly about depression and Parkinson's disease, Christy, published in the journal Parkinsonism, really looking at, does it matter if you start exercise? Do you start it early or can you start it later on if you have Parkinson's? Does it matter?
Well, the bottom line is this was a small study, 31 patients. But what they found was that the people who did early start group of exercise, the patients enjoyed the exercise. It was feasible for them to do it. And earlier participation in this group exercise program did improve their symptoms of depression.
No downside, is it?
Yeah.
No real downside here. If you've got Parkinson's, we can't say it will make you live longer. That research isn't quite there, but certainly it's a great part of your overall care.
Well, that concludes the research that matters. We've touched on CAT scans for cancer, soda increasing cancer risk,
and about exercise in Parkinson's disease.
And about eating on a red plate might help you reduce how much you eat. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break, but we'll come back talking with Professor Isaiah Shai-Arkin Vice President for Research and Development at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, about Publish or Perish, the Battle of Science for Your Health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Professor Isaiah Shai Arkin, Vice President for Research and Development at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, about, I think, a really fascinating topic, Publish or Perish, the Battle of Science for Your Health.
Thank you for being with us, Dr. Arkin.
My pleasure.
And I guess we could start out, Dr. Arkin. You are Vice President for Research and Development at Hebrew University. How did you yourself get interested in research and a career in science?
Well, research is truly a privilege to practice in, because most other things that we do, people pose the questions and the problem to us. But research is unique in that you yourself pose the questions that you wish to answer. So I have always found that a tremendous privilege, and it's really, I feel as if I'm getting paid to, practice my hobby.
We're going to talk a little bit about what you've learned and written and your opinions about publishing and human nature and exploration. But for our listeners who are not involved in research and science in their careers, help us understand and get a sense of what happens when a scientist tries to publish in a journal.
So what you try to do is you come up with an idea and you gather some funds in order to pursue that idea. Now, even in the humanities, you need to, despite the fact that obviously experimentation there is much cheaper, but it always requires some funding. And after you undertake the research, you want to publish it. You want to basically show other people in the world what you've done, and perhaps even more importantly, to get their feedback. And what you do, you try to gear your publication to a particular journal. Now, here is where it gets a bit tricky. What you want to do is you want to choose the best journal that has the largest audience, obviously. However, the more prestigious the journal, the harder it is to get your publication in it. And what you do is you send your preprint, your manuscript, to the journal, and then it is evaluated by an editor or editors. In most journals, what happens after that the editor assigns peers, which are normally researchers such as yourself, to evaluate the work, and then depending on their recommendation, the article might be published or not. Sometimes they ask for a few minor revisions. Sometimes they ask, you might want to add an experiment here or there, etc. Then, of course, they can also reject the paper.
Well, this sounds...
In the
this...
more prestigious journals, quite often the editors view the manuscript, and quite often they decide to reject it even without sending it to peer review. So the more prestigious the journal it is, clearly the harder it is to get your publication in.
Now, Christy and I will frequently, when we talk about research that matters on our show, we did it just a little while ago, we will frequently look at research across a whole host of journals, but a lot of times the research that might appear in the New England Journal of Medicine or the Journal of the American Medical Association would appear to be the more important research. I'm sure within the science, we're talking about nature and science. Is that true or not true? Because that is a fundamental question. Or if you're publishing the best research, most people are going to want to publish there, and you're going to have a high rejection rate.
So there's two things that one can say, first of all, not every paper or work that is published in, let's say, those top three journals, the New England, Science or Nature, not every publication that appears there is stellar. And second, not every publication that appears in lower-ranking journals is not stellar. So there's a lot of Nobel Prizes and Fields Medals and other prestigious prizes that were awarded on work that was published not in the most prestigious journals. And there's a whole slew of fantastic anecdotes. One of the best one is by one of the most famous biochemists of all time, a man by the name of Hans Krebs. He's the name for discovering the Krebs cycle, which is one of the central metabolic cycles in our body. And he would go, when he would lecture in front of an audience, of course, after he won the Nobel Prize, etc., he would take with him the rejection letter from the journal Nature, and he would try to encourage young scientists to realize, look, you can still get a Nobel Prize for work that was rejected for publication in Nature. So it's very, very important to realize that there's fantastic work that is published in other places. And in addition to that, there's also work that is published in those journals that is not necessarily stellar. So, again, not everything that appears in those journals is significantly better than things that appear elsewhere.
Well, help us understand a little bit about the pressures of a researcher. So you may have a really good idea and study it well, but there is this pressure and this reality of what researchers call the publish or perish world. I've experienced that with some of my patients and our colleagues who, you know, really have a pressure to publish in order to keep their jobs. Explain to us how that works for most researchers.
Absolutely. I think the top criteria for evaluating a researcher's productivity is their publication record. And normally, you want to publish in a journal as you know, as prestigious as possible. And we use words such as impact factor. Impact factor is the average number of citations that an article gets in a particular journal. So the higher the impact factor of that journal is, it means that it's cited more often. And those publications in those prestigious journals are what drives your research and recognition. So when you want to apply for a grant to fund your research and perhaps even to fund part of your salary, you need to show that what you've done previously is based on publications that appeared in prestigious journals. So without publication, it is very, very difficult for you to get any sort of recognition or any sort of funding for your research.
Well, you know, Dr. Arkin, you yourself published a very interesting piece that I want to bring up now. You published in a journal, Research Trends, this analysis, which is fascinating, about people who publish in Nature and Science, the top journals, because it would suggest that if you can publish in those journals, you are one of the top researchers in the world. But you looked at how often researchers can publish. Again, can they publish more than once? And I would have anticipated, yes, those top researchers can publish multiple times in those journals, but that wasn't the case. What did you find, and why did you end up doing this?
So the idea was relatively simple. I became, I would say, the dean of the life sciences in the university before I became vice president. And as that position, one of my major jobs was hiring new professors. And it was pretty much the rule of thumb is if you don't have a publication in, you know, the top journals such as Science or Nature, your chances of getting a position were slim. So I decided to take a simple statistical analysis of what does it mean if someone published in Science or Nature in these top journals. So then I posed a simple question. What does it mean if you published in Science or Nature? It can mean one of two things. Either you're very, very good, you're a top scientist, and by that I also mean you're very well funded, you have fantastic colleagues, you're in a good university, etc. That's what I mean by good. And the second option is you were lucky. You stumbled upon something that you did not necessarily plan to. And, you know, that turned out to be a gold mine. Okay, so then there's a relatively simple way to distinguish between those two. So, you know, talent versus luck. So if you were very talented, if you're very capable, and that's why you published in Science or in Nature, presumably you're going to do that again, right? Because the talent doesn't go away. But if you were lucky, chances that you would be lucky twice would be vanishingly small. So it's very easy to do an analysis to check who are the people that published in Science and Nature, and what are their chances of publishing there again. And the short answer is that more than 70% of the people that publish in Science and Nature will never publish there again.
We are going to need to take a break, and I'm eager to come back and talk more about these one-hit wonders and ways that we can support research and new discovery for your health. We need to take this break, but when we come back, we'll continue speaking with Professor Isaiah Shai Arkin, Vice President for Research and Development at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, about this concept of publish or perish, the battle of science for your health. We'll be right back with Your Health. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Christy and I have been talking with Professor Isaiah Shai Arkin, Vice President for Research and Development at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, about Publish or Perish, the Battle of Science for Your Health. And Dr. Arkin, you were just describing before the break some really interesting research where you kind of hypothesized that perhaps a lot of the researchers who publish in Nature or Science, and you base this on your own research, may be lucky rather than having this long body of research. And I wonder if you also looked at, are there analogous types of publishing or creative work in music and other sorts of publishing like literature? What did you find?
Certainly. After doing this analysis on scientific productivity, I decided to have a look at other sort of forms of human creativity. So we looked at the music billboard. And to basically see, you know, who got a hit in the last, let's say, 40 years. And we also looked at the bestsellers list in the New York Times. And it's very easy to get those statistical data. And then the question that I posed was exactly the same. If you once got a book that made it to the top sellers list in the New York Times bestsellers list, what were your chances of getting another book? And the answer is very small. So 70% of the people who are able to get a book there once will not get another book. Of course, we all familiar, you know, with the J.K. Rowling and, you know, the prolific writers out there. But for the vast majority of writers and also for the vast majority of singers that got a top Billboard song, most of them will be one-hit wonders. They'll have one fantastic example that will make it to the top 20 or to the bestsellers list, but most of them will not be able to repeat that.
But some
not
of those songs
and their creativity.
And some of those songs, as you allude, are some of the most creative and wonderful songs, the songs that stay with us forever, and then we go back and we're like, oh, that was a one-hit wonder.
It does not at all diminish from the achievement or from the creativity or from, again, from the scientific advancement that took place. But if you're looking at the, you know, what was the source of that, you're stressed not to point out to the fact that this was really a sporadic, one-hit wonder.
So if you are a scientist out there or a family member that has a scientist in your family, what advice do you have for them when they're really beginning to become involved in research? None of us want to be thought of as one-hit wonders, though we all would love to have at least one publication in the New England Journal of Medicine or Science or Nature.
Unless your hit is the thing that changed the world. I mean, you know.
I think what you should, the advice should be that try to do fantastic work, but don't necessarily get discouraged when journal editors don't recognize that as such. I mean, you need to remind yourself that, again, there has been lots and lots of Nobel Prizes that were awarded for work that was not published in the most prestigious journals. So, again, don't view what the editors think about you as the most important criteria for your success. Talk to your peers, see what feedback you get in conferences, et cetera. It's not just, you know, making it to those top two, three, four selected journals that determines one's career.
Well, you know, this is interesting, Dr. Arkin, because just within the past month, one of the Nobel laureates, Dr. Shechtman in California, has come out to say that neither he nor anyone in his lab will publish in the future in Nature or Science. Well, then why is this, given what you've indicated? Because presumably this is a researcher at the top of the game who could be publishing multiple times in that journal or those journals.
Well, I think it's courageous of him to say that, but in all honesty, it is, I think, somewhat easier for a Nobel Prize winner to say that I will not try at the most prestigious journals, because his prestige is already out there. For the up-and-coming researcher that wants to get a job, it might be harder, but I think if more and more people, like Professor Shechtman, go this route, and basically, I mean, he should step a step further and basically say, look, not only am I not going to publish there, not only am my students not going to publish there, but I will try to do my very best to prevent my university from hiring applicants that publish there, because that's what makes the huge impact, the ability of an individual to obtain a job after, you know, getting a publication in Science or Nature. So you yourself, as a Nobel Prize winner, you know, might decide that, you know, you're not going to get any more glory. But I think that, you know, in order to make sure that really those journals don't have as much influence on us as we will, you should go the step further and basically say, look, we will not determine our hiring based on those publications.
And what do you think, you know, as you've reflected on this, I hear the element of hiring researchers and, you know, paying attention to this. But what do you think as a discipline of publishing science and of encouraging human creativity and discovery that can benefit people's health, what do you think we need to change about the system, if anything, to promote quality work and good science getting out to people?
Well, first of all, I should say that while change is always important and we should try to change things, you know, science is progressing well. I mean, if we just look at biomedical research, have a look at lifespan, the dramatic change in lifespan that took place in the last sort of few decades. So clearly there are direct, intangible benefits to biomedical research that is taking place. Now, I'm not complacent in saying that everything that does take place is very good, but it's not necessarily a broken system that I'd like to try to fix, you know, starting first thing tomorrow morning. But what I would like is to have, again, journals such as the one that Professor Shechtman is trying to promote, eLife, I believe it's called, that has more access to scientists all over the world. It has a different and more transparent review system between the peer reviewers and the scientists themselves. I think that will make a big change.
Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Isaiah Shai Arkin, about your work in really promoting research at the Hebrew University around the world, about your work that looks at scientifically this area of creativity that very few people have studied in the way that you've studied it. And we want to thank you for being a guest today on Your Health and sharing your work with the listeners in North Carolina, around the United States, and around the world. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Arkin.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. Adam, we've got some good ones today.
Yeah, we really do. We're going to be able to talk about what it means when you get your blood results back and that red cell count is a little high.
About a blood blister on the tongue.
About what does it mean if you are taking an inhaler for asthma and you don't feel good after you take it?
And also about drinking alcohol while breastfeeding and these tests of safety.
Yeah, well, we're going to dive right in. But certainly, if you are a listener out there and you would like Christy or I to address a concern on our show, you can send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And let's ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call question today. Erica.
I received a call from my doctor yesterday that I needed to return to his office for more blood work because my red blood cell count is elevated. I'm on pins and needles about this and cannot go back for my blood work for another 2 days. What could be causing this elevation? I'm a 39-year-old female and have had excellent health.
Well, we're glad you've had excellent health. That
yes.
In itself is a very reassuring. But boy, I'm sure you're kind of nervous, and I suspect your doctor's a teeny bit nervous.
Yeah, well, and honestly, this reminds us about just how nerve-wracking it can be when we leave messages for people or say, hey, just come repeat this.
Your red cell count's just a teeny bit elevated. Like, oh, is that like leukemia? Which we can tell you in almost all circumstances, the red cell count being a little elevated is not going to be at least the type of leukemia people worry about. That's usually with white cell count elevation.
Right.
So be reassured on that note.
And, you know, a lot of times that number, if it's just mildly elevated, could just be related to you being really dehydrated when you had your blood drawn. Sometimes, and in that case, a lot of the different things we check for and the complete blood count can be just a little bit elevated just because your blood is more concentrated.
And we hope that you're not a smoker, because smoking can certainly increase it. And then, Christy, I had a patient not too long ago. I just kind of said, tell me you're not taking steroids, are you? And he looked at me and goes, how did you know?
Oh, really?
Because steroids can be one of the causes of this. And he had the muscles of a pretty big bodybuilder.
Well, you know, there are other problems with kidneys and liver and medicines and other things that can be related to this. But most likely you're going to go back, get it rechecked, and it's going to be okay. But do follow up and make sure that you get those results from your doctor.
And make sure that you're not Lance Armstronging it and doping it, which we don't think that you're doing. You're healthy and everything. That, no one ever does that anymore. So thank you for a great question. Erica, what's our very next house call?
This morning, I woke up with a blister on my tongue that looks like it's filled with blood. It's not necessarily painful, but it's a bit uncomfortable. I'm a bit worried because I'm not one that deals well with blood. What is this? How can I get rid of it? And can I expect a mouthful of blood when it pops?
That's gross.
I know, but
that's one of the ones I don't even like as a doctor.
It made me kind of rub my tongue around my teeth and just think, ooh, I bet that does hurt a little bit. You know, a lot of things can cause a little blood blister on your tongue. You could have bitten your tongue or your cheek, or from eating hot food. Like, sometimes you can get a little blister.
Have you ever done that?
I've not had a blood blister on my tongue.
No. I have bit my tongue sometimes really hard, and sometimes the cheeks sometimes, you know, usually while chewing gum. And oh my goodness gracious, and you do get this blood blister, and my first instinct is like, I want it to go away.
Do you
want
to pop it or something?
Yeah, you just want it to go away. And unfortunately it does go away, but it takes oftentimes, you know, 2 days.
Yeah, I mean, unless it's enormous, I don't expect that you would notice a large amount of blood in your mouth if it pops. And most likely, it's just going to sort of go down over time, and your body will take care of it.
There's some rare conditions that can cause blood blisters, and These are not likely to happen to most people, but some people can have problems with their platelet levels. Those are the sticky things in your blood that will cause your blood to clot. And if they get low, they can cause a condition where you could form blisters. And there's some other things, pretty rare. So if it's happening, you know, when you're not having hot foods or you haven't been biting your tongue, you should probably see your doctor.
Let's take our very next house call question, Erica.
I'm trying to plan a nice anniversary surprise for my wife. We have an infant at home, and she has not consumed alcohol since she found out she was pregnant. I really want to take her away to a small vineyard because she loved wine so much, but she's afraid of drinking and then breastfeeding our son. What are your thoughts on milk screen tests in the market today?
Well, first off, congratulations. You're getting bonus points. You're going to even make those of us who are not really planning all these great things for the anniversary, I'm going to go do that too. So you're doing a great job, and I like the way you're thinking.
Yes, and congratulations on your new baby. You are planning ahead for your wife, which is lovely. You know, it's a very good decision that she's making to avoid alcohol and try to limit the quantity of alcohol that she drinks while breastfeeding, just because that can impact milk let down. It can be passed through the breast milk. And so she's making some good decisions about this. Milk screen test is newer, and I have not had a lot of experience with it. So
we've read that it's supposedly accurate and easy to use, and you put the reactive pad on the breast milk and it gets full of the milk. And then after 2 minutes, you can read the results and see if there's a color change indicating a high level of alcohol, and if there's no color change, it supposedly is safe. I don't think Christy and I would fully say that we're going to back that sort of approach. On the other hand, we like that you're concerned about passing alcohol and to the child. And so I think this is something we're going to look into a little bit more, and it's reasonable to begin to think about ways of trying to understand this.
Yeah, I think an occasional drink, a glass of wine or a beer here or there, has been deemed okay by the American Academy of Pediatrics during breastfeeding. Like, we want to promote breastfeeding. But if you're going to, like, a vineyard where she's going to be, like, drinking all day, then, you know, there are ways that she could pump that milk and discard
it.
Not use that milk.
I remember one other thing, Christy, that one of your sons told us to be certain that we wanted to mention on the show. Your son Branson said, make sure we tell her to drink milk.
That's right. He said the milk screen is, that means you should drink milk. So everybody drink your milk out there, according to my son, who is 5 years old.
Okay, Erica, what's our very last house call?
I'm a 26-year-old male who takes albuterol for mild allergic asthma. It helps with my symptoms, but it affects my mood and concentration a great deal. Is this normal?
Oh, unfortunately, this albuterol that you're talking about, the inhaler that's used for short-term relief of asthma symptoms, can have a lot of side effects of making people feel irritable and restless, increasing your heartbeat, making you feel nervous. So sometimes people don't feel great after using that albuterol medication.
And it has many other names. Some people call it albuterol, sometimes brand names, ProAir or Ventolin or Proventil and others. Different than the steroid inhalers, which have many other names as well. But the simple fact is most people can get around the side effects and use it when you really do need it there. And you can certainly get what's called a spacer. We talked about this on a show not too long ago to make sure you're getting the right amount there. And there are other formulations you could try, like a tablet or a liquid form. But in my experience, Christy, sometimes those actually cause even more of the side effects, certainly the liquid and tablet form. So I don't know if that's worth trying.
And also, I mean, if you're having to use it a lot, then there are these controller medications to try to decrease the amount of times that you have to even use the albuterol. So hopefully that is helpful to you. We wish you all the best and appreciate all the questions that we've had today on your health.
And if you want to send us your questions again, you can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or our health app.
And we want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Professor Shai Arkin. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of your health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
We look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.